It really is a thrill to be here. This was so surprising when I got the call from Dr. Edwards. I was at work and I looked over at my phone and I saw an area code that I didn't recognize. I didn't even know the book had been entered. So it's really a thrill to be here. Just recognizing some of the people involved in the book here, the Saskatchewan Association of Architects, the Canada Council for the Arts, which through their support for architecture program contributed greatly to this book, and Canadian Plains Research Centre has actually recently rebranded themselves as the University of Regina Press, fortunately or unfortunately. Now, one of the first things I'm going to put up here, and hopefully, am I too far away? Oh, you're getting double, yeah. I thought I'd put the map up. I know it's in the lobby, but this map was so compelling to me in terms of the way it just kind of reoriented my understanding of what the region is. And also to show you just why you have a Canadian standing in front of you today, that it actually takes in part of the provinces of Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and Alberta. And, you know, I recognize this line as the line of the boreal forest, the transition really from the plains to the boreal forest, and this being the kind of red and Missouri River systems and, of course, the Rockies, and then it touches the Mexican border. And one of the things that really interests me as well is just the cities that populate that area, the kind of small and medium-sized city that I'm going to talk about in a minute. Also, just a little briefing on speaking Canadian. I know the problem with the O and the aboot thing, I am aware. So I'm not promising that an A might not slip out every now and then. I'm also expecting maybe to hear a few y'alls. I don't know if I'm in the right spot for that, though. Maybe not. No. Okay. I would pronounce this as Kearney, but I understand it's pronounced Kearney. I would say Pierre, but I understand it's pronounced Pierre. Is that correct? Yes. So you say Native American, we say First Nation. So this term is going to crop up a few times in the talk. So when I say First Nation, you'll know what I mean. I have received a little coaching. Our executive director at the Architects Association is from Peabody, Kansas originally. And so she gave me a few pointers. She said red is the color. So I ordered the tie as soon as I found out that I received the award. I'm often asked why we say Regina and not Regina. And good question, because it really should be pronounced Regina. And I actually had to go in and kind of look up where this name came from. It's actually Latin for queen, and Queen Victoria was typically called Victoria Regina, and it's named after her. Part of my excitement about coming here was to actually see a few things that have been on my list for a long time. I actually flew into Minnesota and drove from Minneapolis to Lincoln here. I saw two of Louis Sullivan's jewel box banks. This is one in Owatonna, Minnesota. This is one in Algona. It's one of the smallest. And they're both really extraordinary buildings. As Dr. Edwards mentioned, I studied art history before I went into architecture. And this is such incredible serendipity. This is a Jackson Pollock painting that's just been unveiled after a two-year conservation effort at the Getty Center in Los Angeles at the museum in Sioux City, Iowa. Again, kind of along the way. And I was very excited to be able to see this. That's been kind of on my radar screen for about 20 years. Now, when I first got the call from Dr. Edwards, I thought, where is this place, Lincoln, Nebraska? And I found there's a lot of similarities. Regina was founded in 1882, Lincoln in 1856. Regina is the provincial capital. Lincoln is the state capital. Regina is named after a queen. Lincoln's named after a president. This all feeds into, I think, Carrie Ronning's review of the book and this kind of commonality that we have across the Great Plains. The interesting thing is the population of the two cities are very similar, and they're both planned around a grid plan. This is interesting. Lincoln's is square. It's 300 by 300. And so is Kearney, so is Scott's Bluff. It's almost like it's a Nebraska thing, the 300 by 300 square grid. Regina's is rectangular. It's a little bit different. We both have fantastic state capitol buildings. The one in Regina by the Maxwell brothers from Montreal, it's in a classical revival style. And of course, the one here by Bertram Goodhue from Boston. The amazing thing is the dates, really, and how close they are together, and yet how radically the styles changed. And this is really kind of the starting point of the architecture of Saskatchewan book and chronologically in terms of its time period. So it sort of leaves behind some of these buildings. The interesting thing is Goodhue actually entered the competition for the Saskatchewan legislature when they held the design competition. That's when he was still working very much in a Gothic style. It's the original plan for Regina. Very simple. Love the Library of Congress. You can find almost anything online there now. The point here is a lot of the elements are the same. There are railway lines that come through, station here, and the grid is punctuated by these kind of very simple parks and squares. And I think also this is very interesting. This is an image taken by Chris Hadfield, a Canadian astronaut from the space station, as they were orbiting over Regina in the wintertime. This is Lincoln. The interesting thing is here, we're on this great expanse. For better or worse, we're not hemmed in by anything. In some ways, it would almost be better for the density of the city to have some kind of physical constraint. But both cities really are in this kind of very big plane. The real thrill for me about this award is back home at the Saskatchewan Book Awards, the book received multiple nominations, but actually didn't receive anything because the awards were swept by a very important book on First Nations history called Clearing the Plains. And it's not a pleasant story. It's about our first Prime Minister, Sir John A. Macdonald, and his policy of starvation to the First Nations, towards the First Nations. And I think Canadians quite proudly think, will tell you that there were no Indian wars, that there were treaties, but the First Nations population was really forced into it. Whereas here, these are the books on Native American and First Nation, or Native American history, I guess, that have been recognized by the Center for Great Plains Studies. So in some ways, you've really explored this topic and really recognized this topic. And I guess the timing was just right here, which is fantastic. This is a very interesting image. I thought I'd just throw this in. This is the stockyard in Maple Creek, Saskatchewan. I think 1889, sheep. These are bison bones. So this really represents this kind of notion of clearing the plains, and this kind of, I guess, modernist notion that, you know, we don't understand the thing that's here that's actually adapted to the place. We'll replace it with something else. Sheep never did well in this spot, that only lasted for a while. The review in Great Plains Quarterly I found quite gratifying. I kind of read this quote. It said, however, this is not just a pretty picture book. And it speaks to really the, even the captions, how they were created to kind of enhance the book and really form part of the text. It is a visual history. It is very image heavy. But there was a lot of care taken to in the writing of the captions. Almost, it really almost took more time than actually doing the text. And I thought, wow, they got it. It was kind of understood, which was very nice. The book doesn't take a critical stance. It's meant to be very educational and informational. And it's intended for a very public audience. When we went to the Canada Council for funding, they actually liked this position because they said the last thing we need is another book just for architects. We don't need a book for the club. We want to educate the public. And the story, broadly, is really one about the arrival of modernism and modern architecture. It owes much to Kenneth Frampton and also one of my own mentors, George Baird. Kenneth Frampton, a professor at Columbia University, who wrote a text on modern architecture in the early 80s. And this book really puts the buildings in Saskatchewan in kind of that framework. So it owes a lot to his work. And one of the things that we really strove for in the photographs and in the layout of the book as much as we could, and it's interesting, it took such a long time to put this thing together. It actually took 10 years from start to finish. And in that time, the publishing industry got turned on its head. And, you know, you had new devices that came along and all kinds of stuff like that. And there was a really concerted effort to kind of, you know, we really said to ourselves, why a book in this age? Like, should this be something web-based? And we very consciously tried to make it a beautiful artifact and one that you would actually want to have and hold in your hand. And one of the inspirations was a book by a friend of mine, Marion Banshees. Yes, I've got her website here if anybody's interested. She calls herself a graphic artist. She's from Saskatoon, Saskatchewan. She lives in Vancouver. And she's really kind of hit the international scene. She's doing a lot of work for magazines and organizations all over the world. And this is a book that she put together about her own work. It's printed and bound in England. The cover is satin. This is gold leaf, right? So obviously we didn't have any of that, but as much as we could, you know, we tried to give it a quality of this, something that you'd want to have the book. And I'll just pass this around. Now, this I want back. Now, also, it was conceived as a sequel of sorts to this book that came out in 1986. And this one actually, it's coincidental that this one in 2013 was scanned and put online by the University of Saskatchewan. And we actually made a conscious effort to even mirror the format so that the two can actually sit beside each other on the shelf so that, you know, if you have the previous one, you kind of now have a set. And almost by accident, even the cover design, you know, one is black, one is white. They're both very kind of frontal elevation images. And I can pass this one around to anyone who wants to have a look at that. Now, I actually went to the main library in Regina, and you know, this is why. This is the section on Canadian architecture at the main library in Regina, Saskatchewan. And two of the books are the 1986 book, and one of them is this book. And actually, it ends there, right? So, and we have Lisa Rochon's book, who wrote the foreword for this book. And the great book on Canadian architecture by Hal Kalman, it's a two-volume set. So, there's a few others, but this is it. You can see where we're at with this topic and, you know, why we're kind of starting from kind of ground zero here. One of the challenges is, and again, this is why it took such a protracted time to get this thing together. Architects aren't the most literate creatures, unfortunately. We're very visually oriented, and it's very challenging for me. I mean, I produced the text for this. It was a great challenge. I found it much easier to deal with the images, to kind of choose them, curate them, figure out that sort of aspect of it, as opposed to producing the text. And it's maybe why we don't have very much research material on architecture. it was a personal priority for me to really kind of cultivate these visual skills and do something that I call promote a culture of architecture. I don't know how else to really describe that. I traveled to Chicago in 2006 for a wonderful tour hosted by the Society for the Study, Society of Architectural Historians in Chicago. And what astounded me was the depth of knowledge almost everybody I ran into had about architecture. In Chicago, there really is a deep sense that you're living in a city of great, great architecture. And I think that's a wonderful spot to be, but it's unfortunately not where every place is at. And it was also a personal priority just to raise the issue of the conservation of modern heritage. The first book really deals with the kind of more traditional heritage buildings, the brick and stone buildings, sort of 1930s and earlier. And really, some of the buildings that were built in the mid-century and the modern time are disappearing faster than we can imagine and not even being studied or recognized. My own sensibility, heritage conservation thinking, includes ideas of minimal intervention and repair before replace. Getting into heritage conservation has really evolved my thinking about architecture. Things like a long life cycle, repairability, connects this issue to sort of current issues of sustainability, for example. These statements carry a lot of meanings. Ones like understanding before intervening. And I hope you'll see what I mean when we rattle through some of the slides here. Why is any of this relevant? And the big question is, in my mind, are we building places where people want to be? It's interesting right now in Regina and in Saskatchewan, we're in the midst of a resource boom. And what you constantly hear is that there's a skills shortage and trying to attract people to move there. And it's hard because it's not necessarily a place where people want to be, and I don't think people can figure out why. There's climate issues, but I don't think that's fully it. It also relates to a kind of urban environment and a sense of public life. I thought I'd put this up. This is actually where I grew up, and the house and farm that I still own, believe it or not. Built in 1924, I may have been the last generation to grow up without plumbing. And trust me, when you don't have the tap, when you have to bring it in from the well, you don't use much water. And I think I still carry this sensibility with me. It's made me, I think, very in tune with some of the tenets of heritage conservation and ideas about minimal intervention. Now, I was at the Heritage Canada conference a few weeks ago, and Randall Mason from Penn State University gave this amazing lecture that really dovetailed with some of my thinking of about a kind of bigger look at heritage conservation that doesn't just relate to individual buildings, that really relates to the city. And he's looking at his hometown of Atlantic City, and he used the term maximizing tendencies. And I think we see this very strongly these days. He was referring to some of the casinos that were built in Atlantic City at enormous expense, one of them that has now gone bankrupt, I think twice. So there's incredible challenges there. But it gives a kind of term that can be used as kind of the opposite of the sensibility of minimal intervention. And I think we see this very strongly these days in some of our current architecture. And of course, there's these kinds of images. I did a little spot for Global TV a couple of months ago. They called me up and they said, could you do something on abandoned farmhouses? And I said, sure, I have four. what I realized here when we were out there is this house was never wired for electricity. I don't think these people survived the Depression. I know that the sensibility that I carry with me probably comes from my grandfather. That little brick house there was a series of them that were built in the area. And we have one of the smallest ones because I think my grandfather was very conscious about not the maximizing tendencies, but doing something he could afford and something that would be sustainable over time. and durable and repairable. And so, you know, it's in a way, I'm saying everything I need to know I learned on the farm, and that may be true, but of course my wider education has made me make sense of it. Now, these kinds of buildings were not my entry into heritage conservation. It was actually these buildings that were. And in 1997, you know, working in an office and started work on the addition to the Edmonton Airport in Edmonton, Alberta. And it came across this really extraordinary series of buildings that were built between 1960 and 1966. High modern style, and an amazing art program where there was these large-scale murals that were created for these buildings. And what really attracted me to all of this was these incredible images, believe it or not. And this really was my entry into heritage conservation. This is when I first started to study it and write about it and publish about it. And so this was really a turning point for me. And you can see that this last photo was by Henry Kalin. And this, of course, is not Saskatchewan. This is Palm Springs. This is the iconic Kaufman House. And the iconic photograph of that house by Julia Shulman. And it's really in that vein that a lot of these images spring from. This is, again, another Henry Kalin image. He was a photographer in Winnipeg, Manitoba. He was trained as an architect. And this one took the cover. This is the heating and cooling plant at the University of Regina by Clifford Weens. And we mined his archive, I have to say. I didn't realize he took as many pictures as he did in Saskatchewan, but I think every single photograph of a building that he took in Saskatchewan is in the book, because they're all fantastic. And it's these kinds of images that contributed, again, to that notion of a beautiful artifact that goes beyond, you know, what you can view on the internet. The other graphic idea that we had, since we were using a combination of archival photographs and new photographs, mainly overall images, that we decided that perhaps the chapter openers should be these, you know, really kind of zoomed in details of something that would really kind of represent that chapter. And the chapters are very simple. It goes chronologically. It's roughly decade by decade, but not quite. Some of the decades are combined. And this is so these were new photographs that we generated. This is the door handle at the CBK transmitter building. Believe it or not, it took about 5 hours to get this shot. At one point, I thought we were shooting a supermodel or something, but this is the frieze at the Royal Saskatchewan Museum, representing the 1950s. This is the tile work in the lobby of the Saskatchewan Power headquarters building. The colors are meant to represent the boreal forest. This is the underside of the concrete waffle slab at the Sturdy Stone Center in Saskatoon. So this was the 70s and 80s. We see getting into a kind of very muscular, exposed concrete expression. And then this is the last chapter for the 90s and the 2000s. So we have steel, stone, tile, concrete, and glass. And this is, again, one of the little artworks that you find throughout the book. John Nostaden collected phrases, scientific formulas, a laboratory building, that are imprinted throughout the building in different materials and in different ways. And when I saw this image, it's actually one of the, I was very clear in my mind about what I wanted for the previous chapters, but couldn't figure out quite what I wanted for the last one. And it's actually one of the photographers that suggested this. And I looked at it and I said, well, LOL, is that from the periodic table? I said, that can't be laugh out loud, can it? Is it an element? And I contacted the artist, and he said, oh, you caught me. He said, this was my little joke that I put up on the fifth floor balcony. So I didn't give it away in the book. I describe it as a rare and precious element. So So the chronology, this is your little history lesson on Saskatchewan. It's really very simple. Significant date in 1882, that's when the railway arrived. So really before that is the First Nations period. A lot of transportation focus on the Churchill River, which runs really sort of more to the northern part of the province. The railway sort of opened up the southern part. And the territorial period, which lasted between 1882 and 1904. And believe it or not, the little town of Battleford, Saskatchewan, was actually the capital, and then it got moved to Regina in 1882. So you see buildings like this. You do have the wonderful Gothic church on the Churchill River at Stanley Mission, which is absolutely astounding. But you see these very modest buildings. In 1905, the province was formed, and suddenly you've got these kind of professionally designed buildings, a lot of them from architects in Montreal, because we just didn't have the profession. And with the first book, that's the line, that's the kind of cutoff line, chronologically. So this is where this book picks up. And so these are the chapter headers. It's fairly obvious. I was told by one of my more learned academic friends that this is kind of a received chronology. It's actually fairly obvious. So what I'm going to do now is I'm not going to go through the whole book, but I'm just going to hit a couple of highlights. To maybe whet your appetite, hopefully. So where we start, and this is very interesting for me because this is not dissimilar in style from your state capitol building here. It conveys kind of the same sensibility. And I think it's often thought that European modernism kind of swept away the revival styles, but I think even before European modernism arrived, things were changing. So this is really not a revival style building. It has some very traditional elements, but it has also streamlined corners, and it has this kind of simplified expression that was starting to point towards a more contemporary style. This was actually in Minneapolis just a couple of days ago. I saw this as part of the Westin Hotel, but it's a former bank. And it's from 1941. Which is interesting to me because in Canada, we entered the war a few years earlier in 1939. And so here, major buildings were still being built. But again, this shows this kind of contemporary expression that's not European modernism, that's still kind of decorated, but it's not the revival styles either. So it's interesting, in the 30s, things are moving towards a more contemporary architecture. But what we have here, and this is an extraordinary building, is a small transmitter building in Watrous, Saskatchewan. And I would argue that this really is influenced by European modernism. It's white, it's cubic, it's asymmetrical, it has the ribbon window and the corner window, and all of those elements show up in Corbusier's white architecture from 10 years earlier. The architect here, David Gordon McKinstry, was in-house at the CBC. Believe it or not, never trained as an architect. He apprenticed, but had no formal training. And just 2 years before did this building. So this is obviously different. It's much more in the style of the streamlined period from the 1930s that really kind of connects to the Chicago exhibition of 1933 and 1934. The Canadian Broadcasting Corporation was only formed in 1936, so it's amazing how quickly they got this infrastructure underway. And so there you can see it, and a kind of celebration of the mechanical system on the exterior as well. This was the first building in the province to have air conditioning. And if you think about it, the transmitter was entirely run with vacuum tubes, which generated a lot of heat. And that actually had an influence in the planning of the building. There was a notion that the public would actually enter this building to kind of view the new marvels of radio technology. So it had this is the entrance here, and then you split, you go inside, you go up to the studios, into the transmitter area, or into this little viewing gallery that's separated by a railing. And apparently the viewing gallery, the public access to the building was only open for a few months. This opened in the spring of 1939. And as soon as war was declared in the fall of 1939, public access was closed. So you have this time capsule of this amazing building that was extremely well built, that is still in such beautiful, beautiful condition. All still original. The console was here. There's almost like a proscenium arch that the transmitter front kind of was placed in. And then all the works were in behind here. That's where the vacuum tubes were and all the kind of technical part. It's a beautiful map of Canada inlaid in linoleum on the floor. That's the spot right there, CBK. This is in Sackville, New Brunswick, and just gives you a glimpse of what the console would have looked like and also what the front of the transmitter would have looked like. Much bigger building. They also had shortwave there. And this one's in Quebec. I just threw it in because I really like it. There's this amazing series of buildings that is kind of unstudied. It's generally thought that the John B. Parkin office in Toronto kind of brought modernism to Canada in the 50s. But I would actually suggest it arrived through these little radio buildings a little bit earlier than that. And even almost 10 years later, in 1947, we were still getting these very kind of traditional buildings. Again, not a revival style, but decorated, symmetrical, very much a kind of Beaux-Arts planning. And then once we get into the 50s, the chapter on the 50s is probably the only one that has a real thesis to it, this notion of modern or not modern. And what we see is a kind of tug of war that happened, and not just in the province, but really on a national level, of this kind of tug of war between European modernism and these more traditional buildings. This, believe it or not, is a student work from 1950 at the University of Manitoba. So this is what the students were interested in at the same time that the architectural profession was still kind of doing these heavy stone buildings, decorating them, things like that. University of Manitoba, where most of the Saskatchewan students went to, it really embraced modernism. Their director, his name was John Russell. He was an American. He encouraged his students to go on to do grad studies in the U.S., mainly at places like Harvard and IIT, and they often came back and brought this kind of very, very rigorous modernism back with them. But this building dates from 1955. So you can see the massing is contemporary. It's kind of this low horizontal. I wouldn't say it's modernist, but it's certainly contemporary. But it's decorated with this carved frieze and these figures. And I have a quote here from the Royal Architectural Institute of Canada Journal of the day, from the director of the National Gallery of Canada, Alan Jarvis, when he was asked about architecture across the country. And he said, but the prize, the award for the silliest building in Canada goes to Regina. It is the provincial museum. They seem to have said, we have $1 million to spend on a public building, so we have to be pompous. Then somebody said, we have also got to be modern. So they made something that was the silliest creation I've ever laid eyes on, a modern pomposity. In the West, they are being pulled back by the old school that believes public buildings somehow have to be dignified. They say we have got to have sculpture on the buildings, so they put on a row of ducks. I hope the natives go out and shoot at them. It was a different time. But the first time I presented this, somebody in the audience made a very good suggestion. They said, you know what, this was still very close to the events of World War II. And indeed, if you look at something like the German Pavilion from 1929 in Barcelona by Mies van der Rohe, and then the German Pavilion in Paris in 1937 by Albert Speer, we see the controversy. And we see this kind of flowering of modernism in Germany that was wiped away in favor of a kind of contemporary but more traditional architecture. But by the end of the 50s, we see buildings like this. This is Clifford Weems. So right after he got out of school at Rhode Island School of Design. And then buildings like this by Joseph Pettick. So we have architects now, for the first time, that actually grew up in the province, that went away and studied architecture. In this case, Pettick apprenticed. He didn't have a university education. But are starting to do buildings in the province. And then we get into the 60s. And the 60s is one of the biggest chapters. There was a lot of buildings, the building that went on. The fantastic Saskatchewan Power Building, this is by Joseph Pettick. He actually traveled to Brazil before he came back and did this design. He actually came back and did a Brazilian modernist building, which is quite extraordinary. And this is a small building he did in the town of Wynyard. It's a library and town office and fire hall. But again, it has this kind of expressionist bent. This is a centennial project from our national centennial in 1967. This is in Humboldt, Saskatchewan. And these are the types of buildings that I really love, these kind of little modern, very ordinary buildings, but really done in quite a lovely way. And I'll talk about that in a minute. And then, of course, this building, the heating and cooling plant, this received actually several awards when it was new and continues to get recognition for just its incredible form. And there's a whole kind of structural sensibility that goes with it. These massive precast beams are actually tied together through the floor. This kind of post-tensioning that happens through the floor to kind of pull the thing together. And of course, it has this wonderful glowing symbolically at night. Another great architect, John Holliday Scott, we also see people coming in from Britain, for example, after the war. And Holliday Scott did a wonderful job with several buildings at the University of Saskatchewan that really kind of take the traditional stone and Gothic expression and kind of update it and really, you know, kind of give it a contemporary feel without either emulating the Gothic or assaulting it. It's a real incredible balancing act. And this is the chapel inside. I think there's almost something Japanese about this, the way the concrete is expressed, but it's also contrasted with wood and stone. And then there's drawings throughout the book that show how drawing styles have changed through the different eras. This is a particularly nice one by an architect named Roger Walls from the 1960s. And once we get to the 70s, I actually coined a term, I think. I called it soft brutalism. I think in Saskatchewan, we never really embrace the kind of raw concrete expression. So our brutalist buildings are all clad in stone. So they've got a kind of, in the end, a more lasting quality. And had I had more time, one of the challenges of the book, there's over 180 projects, and it's almost like each one could sort of flower into its own research project. Had I had more time, I think, you know, there's a few of the brutalist buildings that kind of got away on me and that maybe should have been included. But I think there was a real sensibility somehow that the raw concrete wasn't the right thing. Right, so they're often clad, they have this massiveness, but they're clad in stone or brick or another material. Now, one of the things I wanted to also try to represent some of these buildings, these are some of the tougher ones, but still really quite great designs. This is the bus depot in Saskatoon. And so this is a new photograph that we took. And also some of these structures that are kind of unsung, but really are kind of a great use of material and very simple and very energetic. It's the wayfinding and direction board at the University of Saskatchewan. Now this is one of the landmark projects, I think, and it's one that's very unsung. It looks a bit odd. But this is the Conservation House in Regina, Saskatchewan. This was done in 1977. in the wake of the 1973 energy crisis. And it pioneered super insulation. It's oriented towards the sun. It has these shutters that are very interesting, thermal shutters. This kind of predates high-performance glazing. And it has thermal solar, so it actually had kind of active solar energy system and a holding tank for the warm water, and an air exchanger that would transfer the heat into the building through a forced air furnace system. Done by an architect named Hendrik Grohl in conjunction with the Saskatchewan Research Council and the University of Saskatchewan. And I think also owes something to the work that was going on at the time at the University of Minnesota. Very 70s on the inside. You can see the kind of color palette. And these drawings are quite interesting. When I saw this, this is actually the street front. And it doesn't actually make sense until you go and see the building, because there's a forest standing in front of it now. I think they went a bit overboard on the landscaping and decided to kind of build this shelter belt or plant this shelter belt in a suburban condition. So it's sheltered from the north and then very open to the south. We see the rise of postmodernism. This is Clifford Weens trying his hand at a kind of different style, but it's still this great building, and it has a kind of minimalist sensibility in the details and a kind of wonderful, surprising atrium on the inside, and a sort of there's a connection right from the council chamber all the way out to the street through this lobby, supposed to symbol the kind of transparency of municipal government. And then we get into the later time periods. This is, as far as I know, the first and only, still only, building in Saskatchewan with a green roof. So this is a LEED certified building. We're getting into the 90s and 2000s here. Some of the, again, the rise of concern about issues of sustainability. Really, that 1973 energy crisis and that conservation house, those issues are all still with us, I think. I'm not sure any of those have been really sorted out. And we see a kind of almost rebirth of a kind of interesting form of modernism. Very modest building here, and very, very quite nice. This is a drawing, and again, I don't have them all, but if you go through the book, you can kind of see a chronology of how architectural drawings have changed through the time period. Whereas now they've become these kind of photorealistic renditions of a new building at the University of Saskatchewan. This is the RCMP Heritage Center by Arthur Erickson, probably one of our most famous Canadian architects. And this is really one of his last buildings. He passed away after that. And the First Nations University of Canada on the campus of the University of Regina by First Nations architect Douglas Cardinal. And these two buildings are probably the closest that we're getting towards the kind of star architecture phenomenon or star architect phenomenon that has become so prevalent. And I see a few nods. Does everybody sort of know what I'm talking about here? I have a couple of examples. This is Rem Koolhaas at the Seattle Library, a Dutch architect. This is Bjarke Ingels in Copenhagen, one of his residential buildings. This is Daniel Libeskind at the Royal Ontario Museum in Toronto. This is Frank Gehry at the Disney Concert Hall in Los Angeles. This is Frank Gehry at the Art Gallery of Ontario in Toronto. This is actually just around the corner from where he grew up. And this is the building that I just saw in Minneapolis. This is the Walker Center by Herzog and de Meuron from Switzerland. So what you have now is you have this phenomenon of kind of international architects that are creating these kind of iconic buildings globally, all around the world. And certain communities want them. I'll quote my colleague Trevor Bodie in Vancouver. He was commenting on what was unfolding in Toronto, especially with the Liebeskind addition to the Royal Ontario Museum, he said, well, the Torontonians are shopping for Fendi handbags. So there's communities that want the designer architecture, right? They want the status of this. And I don't necessarily have a problem with this, but what I do have a problem with, oh, and there's movies as well. Sketches of Frank Gehry, this is one on Norman Foster, and this one is actually very good, not only for his buildings, but on how he's created his practice. It's quite fascinating. But this is what concerns me. It's the flip side. And so, and this is the crossroads from the talk. One of the things that I've learned in the process of creating this book is that we saw a lot of really very ordinary buildings there that were done in a very extraordinary way. I like to call it the extraordinary ordinary. And somehow I think we may have lost that. And Clifford Weens, who did many of these buildings here, he, at the same time that this book was being produced, he was busy writing his own memoir at the age of 88. It's really astounding. And I have it here. I'm not going to pass this around. It's quite heavy. So, but if anybody wants to look at it, they certainly can. And he asked me to write an epilogue for it. And, well, this book doesn't really take a critical position. I thought, maybe in this epilogue, I can say a little bit about what some of my thoughts are about contemporary architecture and how this architecture of Clifford Weens, and I guess by extension, the architecture and the architecture of Saskatchewan book kind of fits in and is relevant for contemporary practice. And I'll just read a paragraph from that epilogue. I worry that the world of current architectural design has polarized into two streams. One being expensive, high-profile projects that are inevitably designed in a very sculptural version of deconstructivism. The other being the vast majority of buildings which are churned out often in a generic, vaguely historical style, rendered in the aforementioned beige acrylic stucco. What I love the most about the modest buildings shown here, and this is in Clifford's book, is their relevance for contemporary practice. They show us how to design an ordinary building in an extraordinary way. It is, I think, an example of what architectural critic Paul Goldberger has described as a key quality of architecture. And I'm quoting here, that architecture is art and not art at once, that it is an experience of the everyday and also potentially an experience of the transcendent. And we see in some of these buildings a very kind of transcendent experience. And it even goes back to these jewel box banks that I'm sort of traipsing around rural Iowa to look at. They are an example of the extraordinary ordinary. There is Clifford's book. And there's one of his buildings. This is the Nugent Studio. A very simple building for an artist. Clifford always says they built it for $3,000. And here, this starts to show you maybe some of the influence that the book has had or not. Right? This is one of those ordinary buildings. That was an archival photo. This is a new one. It's recently been renovated. And this is what it looks like now. And it's very interesting when you read the planning report. Because the planners, there were public meetings, and I went to them, I voiced my concerns, and the planners were very good at capturing all the comments. And they said here, respondents have expressed great attachment to the facade and overall design of the current store, particularly the marina-style roof and large expanses of windows. The current store is viewed as the hub of the neighborhood, and any alteration of the look of the store should be respectful of the building's iconic identity within the community. Well, unfortunately, the response was, the applicant has been reluctant to deviate from the new lifestyle corporate image of Canada Safeway. However, other architectural forms in the neighborhood have been analyzed from key cathedral buildings and have been incorporated into the revised design, such as a masonry brick base, limestone accent, red brick accents, elements found on other buildings, not on this building. So, unfortunately, this is the kind of climate that these kinds of things are working in. I'm not one of those heritage conservation people that believe things have to stay frozen in time. That's unrealistic. The store could have certainly expanded, but I think the front facade could have been retained and repaired. And, you know, this building, unfortunately, has been taken down in favor of a grand new hockey rink that's on a different spot. So rather than expanding this spot, the community chose a different spot. It's a wonderful building, but it's not a work of architecture, unfortunately. And this one, I should just maybe check my time here. I'm hoping I'm not going too far overboard. Sorry? I'm good? Okay, yes. I'll dwell on this one a bit. If there ever was an example of the extraordinary ordinary, this is it. This is an outdoor chapel, also by Clifford Weems, a Massey Medal winner in 1970. It was our highest architecture award in Canada. It's so simple, it's just a roof. And really here, the siding is so wonderful. It's a Catholic church conceived as a summer chapel. The priest wanted it on top of the bank. It's for a beach community, so it overlooks the lake. So he wanted this grand edifice on top of the lake with a spire. And Clifford convinced him to go just down in a hollow off the bank and to create this outdoor chapel that wouldn't need to be aired out and opened. It wouldn't have the kind of humidity concerns and things like that that they were seeing on some of their other properties. So really, it's just a roof. And its engineering, its structure is quite amazing because these floating corners actually have tension cables in them that come up to a pressure plate. And it transfers the load down through the diaphragm of the wood structure to really the beam here that is picked up in the middle by a cable that takes it up into the pressure plate again. So it's almost like a little space frame. And that's important to recognize when we see what's becoming of it. So there you see the support in the center. So that's a tension cable that goes up to the roof. That's it in plan. Yeah. Well, actually here you can see how wonderfully it's sited here off the top of the bank and in this kind of little hollow. Now, unfortunately, the bank has slumped and it covered one of the beams, which wicked up moisture and has started to collapse. And because it has this kind of complex structure, it's this very simple form with this kind of complicated structure, it's having consequences in other parts of the building. So the side beams are getting overloaded and they're getting crushed. Now, this contractor that lives next door, one of the times I was out there, he was there, and I said, you know, could you stick something underneath here to just hold it up? And that's how it's been now for a couple of years. There's this one little post that it's like the finger in the dike. But there's other problems. Partly because of the architect didn't want too much flashing. So some of the moisture has taken its toll on the beams. That's one of the ties for the tension cable at the corner. But yet, it's never been re-roofed. It's over 40 years old, and the cedar shakes are still performing. It's fenced off now. This was last Christmas I went to visit. That post is still doing its duty. But that's what's happening to it. A little bit of good news. This building has been completely conserved. The Ministry of Government Services, this is the courthouse in Regina, completely removed the stone cladding and reinsulated it and put it all back on in quite a wonderful way. They really did kind of follow a heritage conservation method to it. In 2010, and I'm going to get into just a little statement about cities here, and I have to tell you, I'm not sure where I'm going with this completely. To convey to you just kind of what's going on in my head these days, sort of after the experience of the book. In 2010, I had the great fortune to do a trip to Copenhagen. This was sponsored by the Royal Architectural Institute of Canada, and we toured some of the new architecture there. And one of the offices that we visited was the office of Jan Gehl, whose name you may know. He's a Danish architect and urban designer. There's actually a wonderful movie, it's on Netflix, called The Human Scale. And if you get a chance to watch it, you definitely should. He's an inspiration to me because I think he's in some ways a late bloomer. He spent his entire career in academia, and then opened up an office when he was retired from that. So now he's in practice. And really what he's done is he's changed the metrics of how a street functions. So he includes more considerations than just traffic flow. So often our cities are very detrimentally impacted by traffic engineers who say, well, this road's not functioning properly because cars aren't moving. And it was Gehl who went out with his wife and actually counted people and said, well, wait a second, there's other considerations here. Actually, there's more pedestrians here than there is cars. So why aren't we balancing out this environment in a little bit more reasonable way? Now, the other comment he made, and this goes back to the star architect phenomenon, he said, oh, you're here to see the perfume bottles of the young architects. And I thought this was so interesting. And he's recognizing that these buildings are beautiful, but they're just objects, and they don't connect together to necessarily make a city. And this is a couple of images from The Human Scale, and he does this wonderful, there's this wonderful methodology of kind of before and after. And so I hope you can see that there, but this is a picture where the lanes have been taken out and bike lanes have been added. A kind of public space has been enhanced here. And so it's balancing out this kind of tug of war between the car and the kind of public realm and the pedestrian realm. Now, in the film, he deals with these cities. Now they have, Copenhagen's the smallest at 1.9 million. Dhaka was one of the most interesting because they spoke to some of the city planners who are just kind of bracing themselves for this onslaught of urbanization, of kind of people moving into their city. They're looking at a 30 million population not too far down the road and really wondering how they're going to handle that. One of the things that they spoke about was that rickshaws are being banned from the street because apparently they hold up traffic. So the traditional transportation method is kind of being pushed aside in favor of cars. And the planners are going, if we give everybody a car, where is anybody going to go in this city? So it was very interesting. But it also got me thinking about our Great Plains cities. Because we don't have cities here that are 17 million. I don't even know what the biggest one is. Would it be Denver? I know Calgary is 1 million, right? That would be on the upper end of the scale. And this summer I was doing some work in North Battleford, Saskatchewan, and I don't want to pick on North Battleford. It's a small city in Saskatchewan. It's got a population of about 20,000. And I came across a book that celebrates their 100 years as a city. And they have these wonderful panoramic views of Main Street. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to go out with my iPhone and just recreate this panorama. Well, what I saw just startled me. This building is this building. But look at what's happened here. And then looking in the opposite direction, you have that. So somehow this building got demolished. So I'm kind of using Jan Gehl's methodology sort of backwards here, of a kind of before and after. But the after doesn't look so great. And I'm wondering, what's going on here? Have we kind of, what I see in my own city, we see planning efforts, consultants often from Toronto, They come in, and I understand what they're promoting, but somehow they're not applying it correctly. There's not a good understanding of how a small city works, and especially the kind of public space of Main Street, which I think is still so important and still so strong. As I say, I don't have any conclusions here, but it's you know, some of my thinking about the extraordinary ordinary and just looking at heritage conservation on a more citywide level that is a kind of direct outcome of the book is causing me to look at this kind of these kinds of images. I was going to try and make it out to Kearney, Nebraska, but it was just too far. I just couldn't. I came across this wonderful panorama on the internet, and but of course I was able to find a Google Street View. Didn't take me long to find the intersection. And when you go down the street, the main street still looks quite intact, but I really wonder what happened there. What happened to that building? This building is that building, for example. And then Owatonna, Minnesota, and I think a lot of Louis Sullivan buildings had these little balconies internally to where you could actually, they were part of the stairs, you could kind of pause there and sort of view the space. And the bank building in Owatonna has this wonderful kind of balcony that is internal in the building. Now, I think the staff is using it to corral all the architects that come to see the building, because I was immediately directed up there. They said, you know, you can just go up there and hang out there. Take all the pictures you want. Well, what I found there, sitting in the corner, was this beautiful panorama. And this is the bank. This is the Louis Sullivan Bank. And then I went out front with my iPhone and recreated the panorama. Well, the news here is actually pretty good. You know, we've got some change there. Something's happened there. But, you know, a lot of this, and certainly the space and the kind of sensibility is still intact. Now, and we're getting to the end here. These are some of the urban design images from the book. So this is the railway lands in Regina. This was a scheme that was done through competition, won by a Parisian firm from Paris, France, in 1978. And I couldn't rotate it somehow. The wheels sort of fell off here a little bit. I apologize. So I included this as a key plan. So north is this way. So you see the railway coming through there. Those are the railway lands. Megastructure. Very much in tune with thinking of the 70s. So grade separation of streets, very internalized public space. It was very quickly realized that they could not implement this. And in the 80s, the next urban design trend, the new urbanism, produced this plan. I actually worked on this as a student, believe it or not. Now, north is down in this case. None of this ever has been implemented. The railways don't want to move. But recently, we've had a new downtown plan. And it was kind of startling because, again, consultant from Toronto. Again, lots of ideas that I understand that are great. But somehow, the first project, and there was this rush to kind of do something. And again, this instead of minimal intervention, there was this tendency towards, you know, this maximizing tendency that Randall Mason speaks about. And in fact, they even called it the WOW Project. So they embarked on this renovation of the north end of Victoria Park. And it produced this. And it reminds me of something Clifford Weens once told me over dinner. He said, you know, caution, don't throw every single idea you ever had into one project. And, you know, this is my neighborhood. I live downtown. I walk by here every day. And there's corrugated steel lamps and there's these kind of things. And lots of these light standards. And now, there's good things here. There's these eating places. There's wonderful benches. There's a kind of paved area. This is actually in use during the folk festival. Now, one of the problems I would suggest is it's so cluttered with stuff that it's not very flexible, right? And in fact, when we had the Grey Cup Championship, they actually took out most of the stuff. They unbolted it all and set up this big tent. Well, to me, that's not the hallmark of a good piece of public space. There are times when it functions as Jan Gehl would want it to function. as a kind of public space. But unfortunately, see, this is it here. This is the downtown. And we really just have four cross streets. And what happened was the traffic study was done kind of after the intervention. And what happens is now traffic actually turns here. It can't go through anymore. So it slows down and it turns. And in some ways, I think it's kind of sterilized 12th Avenue. And it's just very dead now. Yes, cyclists love it. Yes, you can sit out on a nice day. It does all that, but somehow it's balanced over too much. It doesn't quite hit the right note. Again, I don't think... I'm not an advocate for just keeping it the way it was. It needed work. But somehow the bright balance hasn't been hit, right? I would hate to suggest this, but it almost needs to do a better job at incorporating cars, right? It's balanced over a little too far towards the pedestrian side. And what this made me realize, I was thinking about Toronto here, and in downtown Toronto, you don't have four cross streets, you maybe have 20. Well, when you take one out, you only impact 5% of your crosstown traffic. Whereas here, 25% has been impacted. And I'm really wondering if one of the things about a small city is that these interventions are magnified, either positive or negative. I have a new restaurant in my neighborhood. It's become wildly popular. It's really good. And now suddenly we have traffic problems. It's one business. So either positive or negative, I think a hallmark of a small city is that these interventions somehow are magnified. And indeed, on the neighboring street, 11th Avenue, apparently there's chaos. And indeed there is. It's overloaded, right? But unfortunately, they don't connect it back to what they did on 12th. I'm not sure why. So anyway, just to sum up, these are some of the ideas that we talked about today. Book is a beautiful artifact in the digital age. Foster skills and visual skills and build a culture of architecture. So that's really where the book kind of stopped. And then, you know, where my thinking continues is, you know, can we find the courage to build extraordinary, ordinary buildings in the age of the star architect? Should we be following a heritage conservation approach to urban design and really looking at ideas of minimal intervention, repair before replace, issues of durability, versus maximizing tendencies, replace before repair, and disposability? And what are the design paradigms for the small and medium-sized city? Are these interventions magnified? Thank you.
Thank you very much. We have a few minutes for questions. If anybody has comments, yep.
Chuck. Have you had a chance to look around downtown here? Any thoughts about the architecture you're seeing?
Well, I'm really loving some of the old buildings. The Haymarket District, I think, is extraordinary. I'd read about it before. I understand it's an early Main Streets program. What's interesting is, you know, when I compare it to Regina, for example, that the founding dates are a little bit different, and I think Lincoln is a little bit more compact. So there's a kind of lovely legibility between the Warehouse District, the downtown, the state capital area, whereas when you go to Regina, those are all a little bit more dispersed, right? There's kind of, you know, was more space there. I think there's maybe a Canadian-American thing happening with some of the buildings. There's just, I think, more attention paid here to some of the buildings. There's really wonderful historic buildings, and I think that, you know, my impression is positive. The square grid is interesting. Portland, Oregon has the same kind of square grid. It's actually even smaller. So it gives this kind of very fine-grained texture. Blocks are never too long. You never sort of trudge a far way to get to the intersection. So that's a really great aspect of it. Just coming, this whole trip, I've never been to any of these places. You know, I've never been to Minneapolis. I've never been to Sioux City. Right? Sioux City was a bit of a surprise, both positive and negative. You know, there's been a number of things happening there that I recognize, things like traffic engineering, one-way streets, things like that, that maybe have had a detrimental impact on the urban environment. But there's also some really extraordinary buildings there. The courthouse is astounding. And you know, Minneapolis, again, there's positive and negative things there. I think because of the climate, a lot of the public space has been internalized. There's a lot of plus 15 connections, and it's rendered the kind of street fronts a little bit blank, right? When you walk down the street, you don't see this kind of fine grain of shops. I almost got a kind of Gotham City impression of it. Yet, it's very well cared for, and you know, things like the sidewalks use granite and stuff like that. There's a real kind of care to the way things are built. So, yes?
Do you find any psychologists that are interested in the effects of urban design and architecture on the psychological well-being of inhabitants, or does that exist somewhere?
Oh, God. Well,
could you repeat the question to everybody?
Yeah, sorry. Is there a group of psychologists that might be interested in the effects of urban design and how that affects, I guess, the well-being of cities' inhabitants? You know, I'm sure there is somewhere, but that's a good suggestion. I don't know. I think what's happened is some of these disciplines have wandered too far apart. You know, I don't know if people that deal with mental health issues really are conscious of things like the urban environment and the effect that has on people. I don't know. You're heading out of my area here. But it's an interesting comment.
One more question or comment? Anyone? Yes.
Okay, this isn't a well-formed thought, but I was thinking about businesses like McDonald's, where the shape of their building is really part of their brand.
Right.
And their goal is to be recognizable, whether you're in this state or half the country away. Mm-hmm. And boy, there's certainly some bad looking buildings out there.
I hear you. I was going to include a slide of a Tim Hortons outlet that opened in the town of Battleford. And the thing that gets me about it is it's not that it's off on its own and you know it's very car oriented. It's almost that they picked a spot where it's almost impossible to walk to it. Right? And so I think we see this a lot. I see glimmers of hope in cities like Vancouver, where their planning department, and it's taken many years, but they've become much more rigorous. And you know, they're saying to chain stores that, you know, if you want to be here, you have to alter your the design of your store. They still allow their branding, of course, through different means, through signage and various things like that. But they're really standing up to some of the chain stores. I think it comes down to a regulatory issue. Small cities are often desperate for development. There's a kind of all development is good development attitude. You heard the comments about the Safeway store. You know, the planners captured the sentiment of the community through their public consultation very well, but they weren't able to implement it. So I honestly think it boils down to a regulatory issue, and I think you know, civic governments, they have to ask themselves, again, what kind of city do they want to build? And really make those decisions.
So. Bernie, thank you very much.
Thank you. Truly, this has been really a job.
We have a couple more things to do. First of all, we have a drawing. So make sure your little piece of paper get in the box that Katie is putting together. While you're doing that, let me just remind you that on November 7, which is the first Friday of November, We're going to have a great first Friday here. We're going to be launching our ecotourism coalition with those wonderful posters that I hope you've been seeing on the website. And they'll be up in the gallery for you to see in big size. And on November 12th, we'll have the next Olson Lecture, which is focused on local foods. I think there's a little information on the back of the piece of paper on your chair. Are you ready, Katie?
I've got
one more. Okay. Two more. Okay. Okay. All right.
Bernie, do you want to go on?
Sure.
There you go. Can you read that out loud?
Diane Laffin.
All right. Congratulations. Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Who has the little satin book, the little gold one?
Oh, that walked out the door.